Number three side, heads up, reporting the number one side right now. Reporting the 1-2. So we'll tear that whole wall down, that door and that window. Make a big fort window for me there. Can you move the front door out? We got guys saying there might be something underneath of it.
I got two or three trash bags right here. That's all I can see right now. The blood spatter's in the far corner. And you got a couple mattresses laying up against the bed.
Okay, far corner. Give me the first side. What corner? I think you're meeting the 1-2 corner. You're on the 1. So to your left would be the street side would be 2. Do you mean that corner?
Yeah, that's from.
Copy. All right, Steve, we're gonna go forward with the plan with the burner.
Copy.
Want it like we talked about.
Ontario, Medic Engine 6-7.
Ontario, bye.
Is the EOD unit en route and on the air?
Affirm. EOD 131.
Medic Engine 6-7.
Go ahead for EOD 131.
131-67. Make contact with our PD officers on scene. Evidently, this was a clean out of a house where a family member located what appears to be some sort of RPG round. Not in a tube, placed separately, it has been jostled and moved around, is now sitting on top of a box. We have direct access. Would you like to snap a quick photo for it for you or get any other intel, or do you just want us to hold down the scene and wait for your arrival?
Hey, guys, be ready on the number 4 side. We have fire in the front. You might come out the back.
Ready.
Woman on the 4 side, remember your backdrops.
Inside the residence. Confirming you still want fire to roll in?
Roll in at stage.
Copy, they're staged at glass and 38.
Sam A, fire will be staging at the first contact with the first.
This is Lead Stories on BRN.FM. I'm Yatrice Lead. I hope you're all right and picked up speed from yesterday. We had so much traffic that we decided to extend the conversation of yesterday, where we were looking and talking about Christopher Dorner. We opened the show with the police scanner talking back and forth, and you hear them closing in on the house or the cabin where Christopher Dorner was, and they later found him, his charred body, in the basement of that cabin. We started talking yesterday about what exactly are we to understand about this event. We know that the facts are really very depressing, and yet there is something here that we need to understand. I'll tell you the number early so we can get the calls moving. 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. How is Christopher Dorner to be classified, if you want to use that word, given his actions and given his own justification for them in his so-called manifesto? Was he mentally impaired? Was racism the cause? Was this a declaration of war by one person, not only against society at large, the police department in particular, but even at war with himself? As you get more and more information about this event, you see a man unraveling. Why, we don't know. We may never know, but we could only talk about what we do know. And what we do know is how he laid his case out. And there are many contradictions there in that manifesto, that 23-page document that was there. We don't know whether it was the full document. We know that that's all that has been offered as his explanation for what it is that he wanted to do. And what he wanted to do was, he said in so many words, he wanted to wipe out the LAPD because he had come to regard it as a nest of vipers. But there's something there still that tells us about this man. Eric, you're on the air and you can start the conversation.
Hello?
Hello, Eric.
Oh, hi. Yeah, I wanted to make a comment. I was thinking about it yesterday when I was listening to it, and I think it's despair, you know. And Martin Luther King said to deny a man a job is to, in essence, to say that he doesn't have a right to live, you know. And I don't think being a police officer or being any kind of professional is such an easy, you know, becoming a professional is such an easy thing. So, you know, to have somebody stripped of his profession when he's trying to do the right thing, you know, is something that I think could drive a person to that kind of despair where he's destructive, you know.
Well, we don't know if that is that. We know only that this is what he says. You know, we don't have a comparative analysis to offer for that. We know what he said. And this is how he saw the world. It doesn't necessarily mean that that's the way it was, but that certainly is the way he saw it. Okay. The question I have for you, Eric, is this. You talk about despair. Where would the despair come from your point of view? Where would it come from?
I think the despair comes from all that we see happening and a kind of inability of the masses to react. You know, I think there's a destruction of the world going on. And, you know, I mean, it's happening in our face. How can, you know, I live in New York. How can you have the officials in New York, you know, mostly aligning themselves with polluting, you know, the water system, something that's so basic to life, you know, and there's no strong reaction from any of them, you know, against this. There's very few of them that have come out, you know, publicly and demanded to actually know what's going in the water. So that kind of basic, you know, inability to defend what everybody needs is something I think that, you know, me as a person that has two kids, you know, I'm thinking, how can these people be targeting water? You know, and if they're targeting water, you know, what's the extent of their madness?
But what, you know, would so, be, what is your, what is your failsafe? I mean, why would you not do what Dorner apparently did, which is to say, I brought their attention to something. They, mm-hmm. I had, you know, they gave me the wrong end of the stick. Now they've got to pay. What is the parallel that you see with this water thing that you're raising now? Because I'm asking, would you reach that point? Do you see yourself reaching a point where over this issue and your intense passion about it, that you can actually become a water protector vigilante and you declare war on the Department of Water?
Well, I mean, to put it that way, you know, I think kind of trivializes it, because I think, you know, at a certain point, you know, imagine if millions of people couldn't drink the water. Imagine if millions of people in this city, you know, watched their kids suffer the consequences of what, you know, these politicians and these leaders, so-called leaders, are doing. You know, at what point do human beings have, you know, reached that breaking point where, you know, you can't see all of that and not react? You know, and what is the extent of that reaction? And I think, you know, this is something that a lot of people see these situations, and because they haven't been pushed that far, they can't imagine that, okay, there might be a limit, a breaking point for me. You know, I don't know what that is, because I'm not there, you know, and I'm not in a situation where I've lost enough for me to become, you know, a so-called monster, or, you know. So I think a lot of these situations, people rush to judgment, you know, because they haven't experienced, you know, the amount of trauma that, you know, that some of these people have experienced. So they can't even imagine, you know, being there. And I think a lot of this in this society is due to the lack of history. People don't understand the amount of trauma that this government has inflicted on people, you know, on people all over this world. You know, the amount of sponsoring of just wanton violence that's been, you know, experienced by people at the hands of this government in this country, you know?
Well, thank you, Eric. You got us started off in a very, very strong way, because I see where you are linking this particular case of Christopher Dorner having ripple effect, and you're linking them together. Thank you so much for getting us started today. Q from New York, here on the air.
Yes, hello.
Hello.
On another matter of history, something has been forgotten a little bit, because I haven't heard it mentioned throughout this entire discussion, not your discussion per se, but the whole news reportage, that what Dorner did is not new, in the sense that back in the 70s and 80s, it used to be called going postal. And and the term arose with incidents that occurred, a lot of them occurred in post offices, in which individuals who were clearly on the edge of things, many of them were the subject of histories of childhood abuse, and but also they were considered, and this was discussed at the time as far as causes go, that there was a management style in some industries, especially the post office, in which apparently, and this is what I heard, they would hire a lot of old Marine officers who ran the place like a drill sergeant, and with some degree of cruelty, especially selecting certain individuals, and which even staff were encouraged to mistreat or to make fun of, and that these guys would go crazy and actually did things worse than Donner. I mean, these guys would knock off 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 people at a time. And when the phenomenon became so constant, it became so repeated, people, you know, the term going postal came up. And what it meant, what it essentially meant was very similar to Donner, that an employment situation, You can say either as a result of racism or of brutal management style, which was encouraged in some industries, in which individuals were subjected to pressures and humiliations that drove particular individuals over the head. You know, most of us just don't do that. And this was widely discussed at the time. And to the extent that even I seem to recall people were saying, look, you know, the post office has to look at itself and has to see, you know, who are we hiring as personnel managers, and how are they behaving? This was actually a discussion at the time, in you know, after like 7 homicides.
I remember that very, very well. Yes, you're correct.
And what I find here is a complete a memory lapse as to that. It's concentrating on race, And in the same way that when I talk about the Rodney King incident with people many years later, I say many people don't remember that when Rodney King incident occurred, the initial reportage on the nightly news for about the first 2 weeks involved not race so much as white people, Spanish people, Chinese and Orientals were saying, you know, these cops are totally out of control. There were videotapes at garden parties, white middle-class garden parties, in which a noise complaint was made, and the police would come and beat the crap out of anybody they can get their hands on. And there were videotapes of this. And you can hear them saying, you know, what's the matter? Oh, is there a noise complaint? And then, bop, you know, they're knocked on the ground. And there were, and the point was that for instance, the police there were not just racist. They were completely out of control. And it turned out that Los Angeles, for instance, was paying out, I think, something like $70 million a year to violence complaints against the police. And this entire discussion became subsumed into race at a certain point. My feeling was that it's like if it bleeds, it leads. If it involves race, make it racial. Not the fact that you have a police department completely out of control, but make it black against white. And then that's what it turned into. And that's how most people remember it. But I remember it differently when it started. So these are just two pieces of history that I think, are worth
looking at. I mean, that is a fantastic contribution. It really is, because you're right. Going postal, you're absolutely right. I remember, at the time, mm-hmm. in the middle of all of the uproar and reaction to it, it also became a joke because people were on, you know, whenever somebody was on edge, you'd say, hey, just don't go postal.
Right.
You know, it was like that. But
And have you heard that mentioned once during this entire episode?
Well, you're correct. You're absolutely correct. The race element came in.
I'm not offering a reason or cause. I'm not offering a cure or anything. But just history does tell you a few things. And in this case,
but Dorner himself, Q, did raise the issue of race.
Mm-hmm, yes,
and therefore it is the element that is being looked at because we're asking. It leads to the question, natural question, could racism actually be a form of mental illness? Does it cause mental illness? Does it cause people at some point to break and lose their minds? Because one of the things I remember about police recruiting, because this is one of the big ways in which they used to weed out African Americans from the force, was through the psychological profile. They may perform well with the physical, and they may perform well with the theoretical, but they always seem to be knocked out with the psychological. And this was the way that the police force was kept uniformly, pardon the pun, uniformly yeah. white.
Or sticking a pin in a subject you're holding against the wall, sticking a pin in his butt so that he instinctively reaches behind to flick away the source of pain, and then say, he's resisting he's resisting us, so therefore put him in a chokehold and kill him. This actually happened, and they actually had videotapes of this. So the pin in the butt is another form of the same thing you're talking about. I just thought I'd throw that in.
Thank you so much. You've been able to add a very valuable element to the discussion. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Frank, you're up next. Thank you for calling.
Yes, thank you, Latrice. I was going to talk about this in terms of, actually, it's hooking right on to the last caller. But I think in this case, we have to look at the history of the LAPD. That, for a long time, has been a racist institution. It's been an institution that has wantonly attacked the public, be it white or black, but definitely has a racist history of targeting blacks and targeting other minorities, and still does. And so what Dorner was talking about in terms of people being in certain parts of certain precincts in order so they can carry these types of things out rings true, because it rings true to the history of that organization. And I'm kind of not going to go and deal with the way the last caller dealt with it, because he dealt with it in a very holistic fashion. And I think it's very true that the L.A. riots turned out. If you look, go back and look at the L.A. riots and what was happening, it was people of all kinds of races rioting. But they were rioting because they saw what happened and were outraged of it. But this is the history of this organization. So, you know, until that changes, you're going to have a problem there. Notwithstanding Dorner, who lost it, but he lost it because of something that is a very real problem.
Well, there seems to be a suggestion that Dorner began to unravel much sooner than, of course, this most recent episode. And it should have given people a kind of clue that this issue, his name, which is what he kept referring to in his manifesto, he kept talking about the fact that he already is a dead man because he has lost his name, and this was an overriding concern. Do you believe that in the world, I mean, people that you know, the sense of identity being destroyed, does that give you a sense so much of being lost that you literally cease to exist?
Hello?
Yes.
Yeah. It is one of those things where I think that because of the racism, because of the level of racism, because of everything he was seeing, he probably felt that level of despair. And it's one of those things where, you know, you get to that level, and I've never been there, and, you know, personally, the way I look at it as an individual is, you know, what if you're thinking rationally, you're thinking, how will this action change what's going on? And in his case, I'm not sure if his actions will prompt any change in that organization. And so for me, you know, that stooping to violence in a situation like that is never, as far as I'm concerned, necessary unless in some way that's going to change things. And we see through history that it doesn't. You know, they're doing a little internal investigation, and as we both know, that's not going to turn up anything. You know, they're going to label this guy as crazy. That'll be the end of it. And the LAPD will continue to do what they've been doing for years.
Well, actually, you know, we will hear very shortly from his ex-girlfriend, who started to notice a deterioration in his behavior. And it got to the point where she felt she could no longer stay in the relationship because he was unraveling. And, you know, we see this all the time. You know, with me, it was with Colin Ferguson. I could see instantly that this man was unusually wound up. And, you know, then a couple of weeks later, you know, the shootings on the Long Island Railroad, and you backtrack and you go, well, yeah, I saw that, but I didn't know that that was what I was seeing. You know, I just thought I was seeing a very unusually wound up person. But thank you so much, Frank, for being with us today. Thank you. Patricia, we'll hear from you next.
Hi, good afternoon, and thank you for taking my call.
Thank you.
It seems to me that a couple of things are consistent. When you look at the fact that Bill Bratton came from New York City, Ray Kelly is commissioner of New York, of the NYPD, and then you have Gary McCarthy, who went from New York to Newark and is now in charge of Chicago. There seems to be a connection in terms of the policing philosophy. Most of the newer recruits into the police departments of both of the of these three cities come out of the military. In other words, these police departments are run like paramilitary organizations. And I think what happened with Dorner coming out of the military, he somehow didn't transfer a military philosophy to a police organization. And so if you listen to the father of the young man who was the subject of what started all of this, the young man who was mentally challenged. The young man's father himself said that something happened, and that was something that the news, that the reportage tried to make you feel as though Dorner reported something that did not happen. In fact, the father of this person said something did happen because he described his son as being bloody and as being beaten. And
yes, the father did say that.
Beg your pardon?
Yes, it's reported that he did confirm that his son was brutalized.
So something did happen. So the LAPD trying to make it seem as though Dorner reported something that didn't happen, you know, says that they are willing to sacrifice their own for that blue wall of silence, whether it's in a police organization or in the military. And, you know, Dorner was very idealistic, and it's this idealism that kind of threw him over the edge. Most of us possess idealism, but we're not that courageous. So him going over the edge, trying to clear his name, because his name meant that much to him, he knew what the end result was going to be when he chose to do what he did. So, you know, it's unfortunate that our police organizations these days are run like paramilitary organizations, because when people decide to enter that profession, they have to understand that.
What would you say, in hindsight, of course, we are looking at an individual within an organization coming from a military to a, but it, you know, the police department really is like a paramilitary organization when you look about it. But is there a predictor? Could this have been seen beforehand when this man started to unravel and this particular issue became so important to him? Do you think that people just didn't notice, or they didn't pay attention, or they just didn't care?
See, the answer is they didn't care, because people like Dorner cannot exist in these kinds of organizations. It's like somebody who becomes a whistleblower in an organization. They cannot survive within the organization. So what you do is you eliminate them.
Thank you very much, Pat. Thanks for your comments today. Not surprisingly, there were signs that Dorner began to unravel long before his final rampage. His former girlfriend, Arianna Williams, who ended up having to seek an order of protection against him, describes why she said she had to leave him.
Dorner's ex-girlfriend says she fears for her life while Dorner is on the loose. There was a bitter breakup, and the dispute actually landed in court. Now she's speaking out. Eyewitness News reporter Miriam Hernandez is live in our newsroom with what we're learning about Dorner from a woman who knew him intimately. Miriam.
Well, she says at first he was outgoing and friendly, that he wanted her to know as soon as they met that he was an LAPD cop. But as the months went by, she was troubled by his behavior. In court papers, she called him twisted and super paranoid, a far cry from what she expected from a man in uniform.
For somebody like Chris, he was the type of person that, without him having that badge, without him having that job title of a police officer, I really don't think he would exist without it.
She dated him 5 years ago. Arianna Williams says Chris Dorner was unraveling back then. The proud cop and Navy reservist, always on the watch for a possible attack.
He'd leave firearms all over my house. There'd be one, he'd be in the bed, and there'd be one by the bed. There'd be one on the kitchen counter. There may be a combat knife or something maybe I saw in the bathroom one day or in the kitchen. He says, like, you know, you're always on duty. You know, when you're a cop, you just don't ever know who's watching you, who's following you.
She describes a deeply suspicious nature in Dorner, even more acute now as she reads his manifesto, blaming coworkers for his firing from LAPD, that his termination also dashed his dreams of having a family and estranged him from his mother, accusing racist classmates of starting fights with him as early as the second grade. Court records reveal more troubles. Married in April 2007, filing for divorce in May, exactly 1 month later. He filed restraining orders against at least two women. One was Williams, after she posted his name on his website with a warning to other ladies.
Stay the hell away from him.
She says Dorner fabricated stories, and the judge saw right through them.
He did not like that. he sort of got mouthy with the judge, and the judge was like, you're not going to come in here and tell me how to run my courtroom, even though you're a cop. You think I'm going to, you know, automatically take your side?
Dorner's clashes with authority have only accelerated. Williams is scared, wondering as he is loose whether she is on his hit list.
Just kind of looking behind me, and just had the phone on 911 when I opened my door of the apartment. I mean, just, you know, things you would do if you felt like you didn't know where somebody was and you didn't end on good terms with them. Why wouldn't he come after anyone at this point?
And court papers show a similar story with yet another girlfriend who filed another restraining order against her in Las Vegas. Reporting live from the newsroom, Miriam Hernandez, ABC 7 Eyewitness News.
All right, thank you, Miriam.
So it looks like Christopher Dorner was on a downward spiral for quite some time. And when you look at what was bothering him, the things that the former girlfriend cited, not only that he was experiencing these pressures at home, but the important women in his life, also he felt alienated from them. These are really incredible signs. And it is very, very hard to believe that within the department, nobody noticed that this young man needed help. And he needed to be counseled. He needed a serious intervention because he was on a downward spiral. In the police department and in the military generally, it is accepted that a number of the people who are coming in are wired very differently. And even though they pass a preliminary test and they may look well adjusted to the environment in which they're operating, there would be signs that things are just not clicking. And they would hopefully quickly get help because the suicide rate is very high. This is why it was not surprising that in linking the loss of his job, the racism on the job, to the loss of his name and all of this, he concluded, he said it in his manifesto, his life is over. So the suicidal tendency was there. And it boggles the mind that nobody saw this and nobody said, well, hey, you know, you need some counseling. We need to put you someplace where you need to work certain things out. They certainly knew about his relationships. They had to have known that there were some tensions there. The police, you know, the cops know these things with other cops. They know. And many police officers are identified by their coworkers as needing rehabilitation or needing interventive care. 888-874-4888. We would like to take your calls as we conclude the program today. What I liked so far was that, you know, in thinking about this, we went beyond the business of what happened, the one-dimensional story. This is a multidimensional story. And with us, we will find different things that we identify with. This was not just a person who was, you know, a born murderer, but something made him so. This is not to excuse killing anybody. You see in the right-wing media, they talk about, well, the left people, you know, they're supporting the killer. You know, that's a super simplistic thing, and I dismiss that entirely. Nobody wants to have anybody killed. But these things have happened often enough for there to be some kind of organizational response, a far more intelligent organizational response. Because in the end, the police officers involved have to come home. They come back to our communities. They come back to their families. They come back to their friends. They come back to people in the community after they're off the job. But they carry the weight of the job. So you need to have some kind of system that spots people who are in trouble or who could be in trouble, the way it would they would do it in the military. You know, not every soldier out there with a gun could be trusted to carry a gun, and people in the military know that. Some of them may shoot the wrong way. I've covered several stories about soldiers killing each other. This is a huge story for us. And you can see from the input that we've had so far, it resonates at all these different levels because it rings a bell. You know, it resonates. People are reacting because they link part of their own existence and experience with what this story is saying to them. As they observe, you know, they get more and more information about it, or they can get the general lay of the land. So this is a cry to the LAPD once more. This is a very troubled department, and it needs to be, it needs to look inward again, yet again, because you can't believe that Dorner is the only person who is on the edge. He can't possibly be the only one. And if we multiply this across the country, we can see how we get to the point of police brutality, how we get to the point of abuse of power, how we get to the point of abusing people's rights, and how we get to the point where police officers behave differently in one community as opposed to another. They are oppressors in some communities because they too are oppressed. And they bring that traffic, they bring that emotional and psychological traffic into our communities. They bring it, as I said, they bring it home to their loved ones. And everybody pays. Everybody pays. This was a story in which everybody suffered, including those of us who could see, even while, I mean, as brutal and as horrific as this act was, we still have a sense of compassion because we know this is a person in great emotional and psychological turmoil and who had come to the point of losing reason. Except he didn't see it that way. He had reached so low that this for him was a natural progression. He started off dead. He was emotionally dead, he was psychologically dead, he was spiritually dead, because the things that were important to him had been killed off. And that's the way he saw it. Now, that may not be the way it was, you see. And that's where counseling comes in. That may not be the way it was, or that may very well have been the way it was. But either way, he is carrying this baggage. And he is an explosive waiting to go off, and he did. How many more Christopher Dorners are out there? How many more? And this is a department, of course, gathering itself to be impervious to review and impervious to criticism, even impervious to advice, because they cannot admit that they were wrong or that they were negligent in any way. So the ultimate price that Christopher Dorner pays is that he too bears the blame for an entire department malfunctioning, failing to recognize when one of its own is in trouble. I want to thank you very much for the extraordinary insights that you have offered yesterday and today on this. It's a very, very, very important story. And I'm sure as the days go by, we will get dribs and dribs and drabs of other related information. But I feel a great sorrow. And I think, you know, most everybody does. We feel a great sorrow because all these lives, and the lives attached to these lives are now in mourning. And I feel a very special sorrow for Christopher Donner because here is a man in the prime of his life who decided it was not worth living that way for another moment and who decided to sacrifice himself. Again, he may very well have had a distorted picture of things, but that doesn't matter what we think. It matters about where he was. This was where he was, and nobody apparently was able to reach him, and nobody apparently cared enough to see that it wasn't a simplistic thing about what happened on the job. It was about what happened to his life. And if anything should come out of this, it should be the lesson that in your own families, in our own circles of friends and relatives and children and so forth, we pay attention to the signals that they are becoming detached. They're questioning the value of their own worth. That's an awful story to tell, especially about African Americans. You know, it resonates with the oppression of slavery again, where your very identity is wiped away. So thank you so much. Please join me again tomorrow. You can certainly continue the conversation at leedstories@gmail.com. I want to thank you for your earnest and very considered opinions today. Thanks. Bye-bye.